In 2016, cultural historian Christopher Bruard wrote, "The suit is a complex, enduring vessel of meaning whose form raises questions about identity that continue to challenge us today. How is the history of traditionally masculine suiting being reimagined for a new audience?" Hello, and welcome to the Critical Fashion Studies podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Harriet Richards. I'm a lecturer in the School of Fashion and Textiles at RMIT University and co-founder of the Critical Fashion Studies Research Group. In today's episode, I'm speaking to E. Nolan founder, Emily Nolan, about made-to-measure tailoring for women and gender-diverse people. Before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge that we're recording this episode on the unceded lands of the Woiwurrung and Boomerang language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nation. We pay our deep respects to First Nations elders, past and present, and to any Indigenous listeners tuning in. Emily, thank you so much for joining us today. Now, you established E. Nolan, your brand, in 2018 after graduating from White House Institute of Design in 2016 and then undertaking an apprenticeship with P. Johnson. So after studying at White House and then working for P. Johnson, what inspired you to start your own brand?
So all up, my graduate collection ended up costing like $8,000 or something. And so you left going, right, I've got this bit of paper and I have no idea what's next and no savings. And so I looked to tailors that were operating in Australia, none of which were catering to women or non-binary. And so I went and worked at P. Johnson Windsor and did my apprenticeship there. I think after working at P. Johnson, understanding the level of control that a client can have over their wardrobe with the made-to-measure business model, it's not dissimilar to bespoke bridal. And so I was working just as the only female tailor, but just making for men.
So this was before P. Johnson started their women's wear line? Because they have a women's wear line now, but they didn't at the time.
No. And so I started E. Nolan and I started the brand with $2,000 in my pocket that I'd saved, which went towards buying my first roll of black wool. The sort of intellectual property or the point of difference is that we own our pattern, and this is a pattern that we're constantly trying to develop or improve on. Going into my menswear apprenticeship, there isn't an apprenticeship available for womenswear tailoring. You can sort of cut your teeth pattern making in bridal, but being someone that sort of feels like an imposter in a dress, that isn't the avenue that I ended up taking. Previously, I was, even in high school, I was always buying menswear and altering it to fit, because the woes of dressing rooms or change rooms, I really don't think anyone is a standard size, but particularly when it comes to a bust measure or, you know, a hip circumference, the difference from, say, the hip to the waist or the bust to the waist is extreme. It's not like how it is in menswear pattern making, and we don't use stretch. And so going from understanding the intricacies of the made-to-measure business model whilst doing my menswear apprenticeship and then working as a menswear tailor, I wanted to bring that to the wardrobes of women and also create a safe space for the LGBTQIA+ community and also other humans that are disgruntled with high street shopping. You know, you've got modest clients that don't want to be in a change room full of different men. And you've also got people that are sick of wearing things that everybody else is wearing and wanting to have a little bit more control. And so the made-to-measure business model was wonderful for that, because it is this vehicle for choice and also allows for the client to be involved in the process, whether it's creatively choosing the fabric and designing the suit or from a necessity where there's no such thing as a size curve in made-to-measure. So having the option there to control the fit.
I wonder, maybe you could talk a little bit more about why that approach was so important for you, maybe in terms of designing for your clients and for diverse body shapes, but also maybe some of the sustainability aspect of it as well.
Yeah, totally. So I'll sort of start with fabric. So we've got two types of fabrics at E. Nolan. We've got our stock cloths. So these are fabrics that I selfishly hand select over in Italy, in Northern Italy in Biella. And those are fabrics that I will buy around the 80 to 90 metre yield. And then you've got cut lengths. So cut lengths are fabrics that you're just buying the amount required for said suit. And the cut length mills, they create the same way that design houses create collections. The mills create bunches or books. But the beauty of the cut length service is that there is very, very little wastage. And right. so, you know, it's amazing because I don't have to hold stock, but it is also more viable from a cost perspective too. So as designers, I suppose working in other businesses, you take a gamble buying a roll of fabric because
hope other people
and
like
totally,
it.
Totally. And you also, you spend a amount on fabric, and that fabric then sits there, it eats into cash flow, and until you can then spend more money or time to turn it into something that you can sell as a product, that fabric just sits there and is really of very little value. And so the cut length service is brilliant for cash flow, but it's also brilliant for the lack of waste. And those are fabrics that I know that I can move. And it comes back to that sort of capsule wardrobe idea. So if I've got a client that's coming in and she or they are saying, right, I've got lots of black in the wardrobe. I don't think I need a black jacket, but I would love, you know, can you show me some fabrics where I'm going to get the most out of the things I already have in my wardrobe, whether that be, I feel like everybody really has a black pair of trousers. And so that discussion or interrogation, as sometimes it can feel like, I ask so many questions in that first fitting, where are these garments going to be taking you? And so looking at my stock cloth collection, I can usually find something that's going to suit the, I call them wardrobe seat belts, like things that you know that you can reach for and you can depend on to get you through life or the seasons. And because the made-to-measure business is so focused on proximity, because the clients that I'm dressing are either Melbourne-based or they're flying to Melbourne to come and see me. And so, yeah, the fabrics or the stock cloth collection are fabrics that I know can put up with Melbourne's unpredictability as well.
Right.
But in terms of why I will work direct to mill as opposed to sort of fabric agents or even ready-to-wear fabric suppliers, which often have 240-metre plus minimums, is that these mills are heritage mills as well. So they're the same mills that are supplying Savile Row, and I'd say most cut length tailors, I know exactly where the yarn has come from. I know exactly where the sheep's wool has come from. I feel very proud of being able to work with cloth that has that traceability aspect too. It took a little bit longer for the English mills to get on board with things like solar power and monitoring of water usage too. But like anything, when there's enough push from the customer, businesses adhere to that.
Are there Australian mills that you've worked with?
I've heard of a mill in Bendigo, but that is more knitwear.
Yeah, that's what I
rather
thought.
Than blankets woven. Yeah. Mm. And so unfortunately there isn't an industry because we don't have the facilities to process wool.
We grow so many sheep.
Oh my
and so much
goodness.
Amazing
and
merino.
The world's best, you know, between here and New Zealand, we've got the world's best merino.
But then it all gets shipped offshore.
Yeah, but the pelts are sold. So we don't even have the facilities to process that from a raw material through to a yarn.
So just to clarify, so you have your ready-to-wear, which is made in Brunswick, and then you have your made-to-measure, which is made in-house in Fitzroy.
So no, so there's, I think of Enolan with the two different arms. So you've got your ready-to-wear. We still sample in-house all of our own patterns, and then we have bulk production made in Brunswick, Brunswick East, and we're capped at 30 units per order. And so we sort of order as we go because we're still trying to figure out that size curve too. We do offer a size range from size 4 to size 22, which I'm so proud of. But, you know, that's 10 sizes. And so the amount that we're ordering is about 2 to 3 per size. So we operate on quite a lean cash flow or schedule. Now, with made to measure, so that is a little bit different. So in Fitzroy, I fit taking raw measurements. So that's the first fitting. So taking all that data, I will then pattern make and then I digitally transform that into a file. I send that to a 40-person workshop in Suzhou, so in China, and that will get laser cut and have the chest canvas laid. So think of it as almost arriving back to us in Fitzroy as like a shell garment. So the details, I suppose, that are completed by that stage are fabric has been cut, chest canvas has been laid, shoulder expression has been completed. So that is roping, wadding, shoulder padding, and the canvas that's put in the sleeve head. And the facing is sewn on. So that is the turn back of the lapel. It then arrives to us, back to us in Fitzroy, where we have the workroom. Cal, my unbelievable business partner, she's the boss. She runs the workroom. And so between her and we've got another employee called Ruth, the two of them finish the garments to the point where they're ready for the second fitting, which is when the client will come back in. They'll try the garments on. And I should mention as well that that time frame is about 7 to 8 weeks from the first time that a client sees me and the second time that the client sees me.
Which, I mean, is quite remarkable given it's like putting together a puzzle.
Oh, my God, totally. And, I mean, the second fittings, it's so joyful because if it's a first-time client, that's when the penny really drops. Like, oh, my God, this fits. A lot of people go, God, it fits perfectly. It's like, well, you'd bloody hope so. and then between, yeah, second and third fitting, which is substantial, it's still about 35% of the work, all done upstairs with Cal and Ruth upstairs in our workroom.
I guess then following on from that, how have you had to adapt the methods that you learnt in menswear tailoring to fit these different body shapes?
Oh, my God, it has been complete trial and error. A small business is tough and you still cry once a week. That has been the trickiest part, trying to navigate those patterns because every customer or client is different. And so I have a very big bust compared to, say, my waist or even my shoulders. And so from the get-go, I really feel like we were able to navigate that because we could trial and error based on me. Mum and mum's friends were going through menopause as well when I started the business. And so from the get-go, I was able to have almost like a very small focus group that I could go, right, how does this feel? How's your body feel? Learning about anything from endo to perimenopause, menopause. Because I suppose pattern making, I had to first understand what the changes in the body looked like. So I could understand and I could trial and error a fit based on myself, but I haven't had children and I haven't experienced menopause. And I also haven't gone through gender surgery or a mastectomy or double mastectomy, hysterectomy. I haven't gone through that. So a lot of it was trying to investigate, right, what does that a client undergoing those times want from their garments? Because then fitting that comes secondary. Cal and I were both taught how to grade a ready-to-wear garment from a size curve from a 6 to a 12. That is what the universities teach you. I think some brands are sort of going up to a 14 to 16 now, which is excellent. But outside of that, what we've been taught, that was a total grey area for us. And so with the made-to-measure pattern, the only thing that we had to look at that we could get any sort of information from was equestrian pattern making.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there was a book that Cal and I came across. It was in German, but it had all the pattern making, like the diagrams, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And there were things that we were able to adapt from menswear to carry across to women's wear. So the way in which you approach a barrel chest or also posture, and this is from my menswear training, is sway hip or an erect posture. It depending on if the client wears heels, the posture changes. And so I have a very sway hip because I've got absolutely no tummy muscles, big boozies, and I crash all my weight to my lower back, which turns my pelvis sort of in. Now, the moment I put on a heel, my posture changes to more of an erect posture. So it is also having those conversations too with the client because the pattern posture changes. So it's sort of beg, borrowing and stealing from my menswear training as well as trial and error. And then we're coming across this gem of an equestrian pattern making book because that is really the only instance in history where I am seeing made to measure with a focus on women. And I imagine that was for sort of dressage. And
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, the canvassing that was in equestrian wear was quite taut, so quite stiff because it is about looking a certain way on a horse. And so it's then also trying to navigate how much structure is my clientele going to want. So it has been 5 years, but it's still feels like we are babies learning how to walk. But the beauty of making garments for clients one-on-one is that you just have a conversation. Like it is asking, what does the client want? And if that client doesn't know, then educating and saying, well, these are all the options that we have. And I suppose trying to find a happy medium. I remember the first time I made a jacket for a client that had had a mastectomy, and it was just trying to ask questions almost in a bedside manner and going, okay, how does cloth feel against the body? I learned all sorts of things about the undergarments in which women or non-binary folk wear, whether it's a binder or undergarments that assist with sort of leveling out of a bust once there's been a mastectomy. And so a lot of the development has come from working one-on-one with clients and having that as this direct focus group.
Yeah, it's very intimate.
Totally, it is. And I really don't take for granted how important and special that has been to the growth of not only our patterns but also to our business. In particular, you know, going into lockdowns, we didn't have a ready-to-wear collection. We were still just working made to measure. And, you know, that having that intimate relationship client to tailor, I will make a suit for somebody and then they'll go, okay, what should I wear with it?
Yeah, exactly.
Go, oh God. Yeah, I don't know. So the ready-to-wear collection has really been based off what clients were, one, asking me, where do I find a white shirt? And also, I can't find a white shirt in Australia that fits. So the first garment that we did was the white shirt and we called it the tailored shirt. And so that collection, well, the ready-to-wear collection, we have been pattern making from the data that we have collected one-on-one in front of the mirror with the client that I see in Melbourne. And so it is, it's a real reflection of Melbourne women, all sizes that are coming in to see us.
I wonder, especially in terms of your relationships with women and non-binary clients, how do you think the industry is catering to that market? Do you think it's keeping up enough?
We're still not there in terms of size curve, which is why fast fashion does so well. So one of my very best girlfriends has always been ostracized from shopping along your high street stores, even internationally, because over a certain size, these brands just assume that a size 18 wants to wear stretch. Now, the implications of that are the way that it feels, the longevity of that stretch garment, and also how it looks. And so when you get the joy this girlfriend of mine can get from purchasing fast fashion, because for the first time ever, she's not the biggest size on that size curve. So she has the opportunity to size up, size down. That's an important emotion to remember, because a lot of us have the privilege of shopping sustainably because it fits. And so what frustrates me is fast fashion. I hate it. But I do recognise that there is a customer that is only able to receive that joy from shopping made to measure, which is at a luxury price point or fast fashion. And so it goes, well, where's the bloody divide? You know, like what is that solution? And that ready-to-wear brands need to be designing for different body types. Looking at the international shows this season, the models have all of a sudden just become very skinny again. Very skinny again. And it feels so weird.
I know. In many ways, the industry feels like it's progressing. It's coming to terms with lots of things.
Yep.
It's maybe reckoning with its environmental impacts and things. But then,
We're back to Tumblr 2009.
Exactly. We've gone backwards in so many ways. So
with this heroin chic coming back and the indie sleaze,
Which absolutely.
I grew up reposting, you know.
And there's good bits of that, absolutely. Some of it's really fun and quite beautiful, but the worrying part of it is that really limited target market that is being presented on the runway.
Yeah.
And that is a complete step backwards from where we were a few years ago.
I talk a lot with my clients about the invisible age. And so women and non-binary folk that walk into a high street store and are ignored, whether that's because they haven't come in looking like they're going to drop a lot of money to a sales assistant, or the shop assistants there are under the age of 30 and the client that's going in is 50 to 60. A client of mine mentioned it the other day, talking about how the invisible age hits when you go into a store and something that you would reach for, your daughter picks up. And she went, it was so jarring because, you all of a sudden realize that perhaps these clothes haven't been designed for you. She spent her 20s feeling uncomfortable in her skin and learnt to love herself in her 30s and 40s. And then mid-50s, it's like she's back in her 20s again. And so the conversations that her and her daughter have too are they're in the same boat. They're going, everything's changing. I don't know what's happening. Mm-hmm. Things don't fit the way that they used to. What does my personal style look like?
It's interesting too because, you know, pop culture plays such a big impact in this. And so I wonder if this sort of renaissance of actors like Michelle Yeoh and these kind of recognition for these women of a certain age, maybe that might change things because it's like bringing sexy back to the over 50s.
Oh, totally.
Which I absolutely love.
Well, bringing the personal style aspect too. Like I've got to mention what Harry Styles has done for my business has just been unbelievable.
Really?
Like the way Harry Lambert is dressing Harry Styles. Is this playfulness, you know, we saw it with David Bowie, we saw it with Michael Jackson. When, especially with event wear, a lot of clients that are coming to me to get married or to wear to weddings, it's not a black tuxedo. Or, you know, sometimes it is, but it might be one of my velvet suits or bright blue cotton. And the reference images aren't from the 80s. They are from the Love On tour, you know, photos of Harry. I like that people find inspiration from all different avenues now. It's not just the high street houses or the, you know, international design houses, but Instagram plays a huge role in that too.
So thinking about some of the impacts on your brand and on your business, things like Harry Styles unexpectedly.
Yeah.
But also I have to note that you've been nominated for the Melbourne Fashion Festival National Designer Award twice in 2021 and 2022. What sort of role do you think that this industry recognition played in the development of your business?
I think it gives a kind of alien business model credibility. So made to measure, unless someone has visited myself or a competitor that's popped up in the past couple of years, the only experience that I think clients have had in that process is if they've gone through the bridal process or if they've gone overseas and had something made. And so the credibility that the Australian fashion industry has given to Enol and has been really important in getting the word out, I suppose, but also going, no, this is
legitimate.
Yeah, totally. And also the emphasis that they have put on made-to-order businesses too. There are a couple of amazing designers that are made-to-order that have also been nominated. So the first year was Kaluri, who make to order. And I suppose that recognition, yeah, is really important in spreading the word, but also hopefully designers looking at those competitions, if they are going, okay, what's feasible in terms of their own business model, hopefully that they can look into being made to measure or made to order, that there is definitely a place for these businesses within Australia. Yeah. Definitely within Melbourne. There are so many
small businesses.
And we saw that at the NGV Melbourne Now.
Absolutely. And just businesses doing things differently as well. Absolutely. It gives our graduates at RMIT the sense that they can do things differently.
It also, that credibility from these, you know, the Australian industry is the press follows. So the press have been so wonderful in getting the word out about Enol and about these different ways of operating because we are learning every day the demise of Australian fashion houses as well as international houses because the issues with cash flow that happen when you operate as a ready-to-wear business are rife, especially when you're spitting out anywhere from 4 to 6 collections a year. Also, what does that say to the client that you've got to buy what's hot right now, but, you know, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to give you something else that might negate what you've just bought?
So thinking back to when you started and also thinking about what our graduates are seeing, do you think that there's more support that's required? I mean, there's been quite a bit of talk about the need for apprenticeships in the industry because of the skills shortages. What do you see as necessary to support the next generation?
I think design degrees need to be split up into sort of majors. So I think there needs to be a 3 or 4 degree focused just on tailoring. I think a lot of students leave uni knowing how to do a little bit about a lot of things. You know, I did a swimwear elective. Whether or not it's a major or perhaps it's just kind of an intensive elective because a lot of the TAFEs, definitely from when I was at uni, have sort of closed up too. And so, I mean, even going all the way back to high school, I would have loved a sewing subject. Where I went to high school, they got rid of it in the 80s because, rightly so, they didn't want to have a bunch of housewives knowing how to sew and cook graduate. But there is a generation that doesn't know how to sew or sew on a button or mend their garments. And therefore, when going and viewing different garments, they're not always aware of the difference of polyester to merino wool or the finishes of a garment and how a hand-sewn sleeve miter will last longer than a machine, you know? And so I think from the industry, it would be awesome to see more intense study towards tailoring. Apprenticeships, I have the same view on apprenticeships as I do interns, that you should never work for free, nor should you work at a sort of discounted rate. I think any other industry, I know that there are different tiers to other industries, but you arrive at work and you know from previous job experience or from graduating, every business does things differently and there is always that trial period or that probation period where you learn this is how it's done at this business. I don't think that apprenticeships or interns should be not paid for that work.
Absolutely. I mean, apprentices get paid in other industries.
Totally.
So they absolutely should get paid if they're an apprentice in the fashion industry too.
But I don't know if based on the training at universities now, if you can then leave and walk into a production role or a manufacturing role in Melbourne or in Sydney.
So the season of the podcast is all about celebrating the great creativity and innovation in the fashion community in Victoria especially. Mm-hmm. What do you think it is about Melbourne that most inspires you and what makes it a vibrant place to work?
I love how honest people dress here. The clients that I'm dressing, like, that's about as honest as you can get, you know? I think a lot of the vibrancy of the city is because of the creatives that we have here. The press that we have in Melbourne versus Sydney is not so magazine or glossy focused.
It's a tough question to think, what makes Melbourne vibrant? It's like it's ephemeral, it's in the air or something.
Yeah.
And despite this often, like today, very gloomy weather, there's still a sense of vibrancy and bubbling beneath the clouds.
And vibrancy can come in that direct, like there are a lot of grumpy Melburnians. Like, so we're not all.
Absolutely not.
That honesty, God, it just doesn't feel like you're having to read between the lines so much.
Okay.
And maybe from my experience, I feel like it's what you see is what you get a bit more. I mean, definitely in Melbourne events, you know, fashion events opposed to going to Sydney events, but just feels a bit more straight to the point.
Right. The next question I have is, what's next for E. Nolan?
In terms of where E. Nolan is heading, we are pulling the work out of Suzhou. We're working towards partnering with a family-run fourth-generation workshop in Portugal, and that is where the cost of goods is more, but where I think we're going to save money and still be able to offer the same price point to our customers is just trying to negate some of that freight cost.
Right, just going from Italy to
Portugal. Just going from Italy, totally. Even the freight from the UK to Portugal is easier than it is going to Suzhou.
To Suzhou.
Yeah, and then to...
And import costs.
Yeah, and so it's kind of a funny thing to navigate. We just showed up in Portugal and Cal and I driving on the opposite side of the road, going around to meet all these amazing makers. I thought that we would have implemented this by now, but COVID hit and we have to teach our pattern. So it requires us going back and forth a little bit too. And I call them cash hurdles. We needed to work in a way that I could hire more in Melbourne and then get the new location. And so the next cash hurdle is finally swapping from Suzhou to Portugal. And a lot of that reason comes, yes, from the cost of freight, but also for the visibility from my end. I mean, I had plans last year to go back to China, to Suzhou. I love the workshop that we work with, but it wasn't necessarily safe for us to do that, to get ourselves back into China. And so it is really important to me that we are working with a workshop that I can go and visit twice a year. But still keep, of course, my ready-to-wear in Melbourne. So we've got the tailored shirt, we've got a box shirt, which is a boxy shirt, an oversized shirt, which is an oversized shirt, short sleeve shirt, t-shirts and knitwear. I want to hit all other product categories that I believe that we can make better than what's currently out there, and that is coats and outerwear. Ready to wear is kind of a love letter to the made to measure clients and what they've been asking for, but is also a bit of a love letter to things that are sort of niggling away at me. Because, you know, a trouser and a jacket, I believe, have to fit a certain way. And also that fit needs to be well and truly controlled by the client. But something like a coat, we ask different questions to a coat than we do a pair of trousers. And so I believe we can create a ready-to-wear product in a coat. Again, size 4 to size 22. You know, I talk about cash hurdles. We've got Portugal, and then we've got other product categories within the ready-to-wear collections that I'm really wanting to sink my teeth into. So I sort of feel after 5 years, I feel like we've finally getting to the seatbelt idea, you know, things that you harness yourself into and make you feel safe and warm and supported. And then the next little bit in our ready-to-wear collections are the overcoat and then other garments that I want to see with the made-to-measure suiting.
Exciting.
Thank you so much, Emily, for joining me today. It's always such fun chatting with you. Thank you for sharing your vast knowledge of tailoring with us. To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you're interested in Emily's work, you can see one of the incredible E. Nolan suits alongside the beautiful Nagali pieces in the Melbourne Now exhibition. It's on until the 20th of August at the NGV Australia. You can also shop E. Nolan ready-to-wear via the online boutique or made-to-measure by appointment at the gorgeous Fitzroy Studio. We'll include all the links in our show notes. If you're loving the Critical Fashion Studies podcast, I invite you to join us for the next episode. We'll be talking to Post Soul Studio co-founder Myra Spencer about making shoes in Australia. I also encourage you to subscribe to the series in your podcast app so you never miss an episode. As ever, a big thank you to Creative Victoria for their generous support, Thomas Phillips for audio engineering and co-production, Sanam Goodman for social media expertise, and Hugh Caldwell Ross for our logo. See you next time.